is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
All of this had to pay off in some way. All of the parties I've missed, all of the time I put into this, if it doesn't turn into a scholarship, then why did I do it? That was kind of the feeling I had, and it was pretty stressful.
Billy Hansen is the author of the book Harder Than I Thought, Easier Than I Feared, about his experience with sports performance anxiety and how he recovered his skills and love for the game. Billy played basketball at Regis University in Denver and served as an assistant coach there for 2 years after his playing career ended. He presently teaches a course at Regis called Mindfulness for Athletes and is the meditation coach for the Regis men's basketball and baseball teams. His specialty is mindful shooting, training basketball players in the mental side of shooting the ball, and he's worked with athletes at all levels, from high school to the NBA. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Kyle Cavanaugh from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content.
Are you tired of overpaying for your video and analytics platform? Well, it's time to check out QuickCut.com, a platform built by coaches for coaches. QuickCut is undeniably more affordable. It's all cloud-based and comes packed with features to help high schools and youth programs store, share, and analyze game film. Make the switch, get double the storage, and save your program up to 50% on the fastest-growing video editing system in the country. For more information or to request a free trial, visit QuickCut.com/basketball. That's QWIKCUT.com.
You'll want to be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Billy Hansen, author of the book Harder Than I Thought, Easier Than I Feared. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And we are pleased to welcome tonight to the podcast, Billy Hansen, the author of the new book, Harder Than I Thought, Easier Than I Feared. First of all, Billy, welcome to the Hoopheads pod. And secondly, go ahead and share with people in our audience what the book's about, why you wrote it. Just give us the quick elevator pitch and where people can find the book, and then we'll dive into some of the nitty-gritty details.
Thanks, Mike and Jason. Yeah, really appreciate you having me on. I'm happy to be here, and I'm a big fan of the show, so thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
The book is, like you said, Harder Than I Thought, Easier Than I Feared, subtitle Sports, Anxiety, and the Power of Meditation. And It's a book about my own athletic journey and specifically some of the challenges that I faced in college basketball, some of the mental difficulties that I experienced, and how the difficulties on the court affected me off the court, and ultimately about how doing something that I never thought I'd do, learning the practice of mindfulness meditation, working with a sports psychologist, helped me get back on the path and slowly recover. And so it's in some ways an argument for athletes taking their mental health and more seriously and making mental training, deliberate contemplative practices a part of their athletic routines. And beyond that, I also go into other dynamics about modern athletics, about drugs and party culture in high school and college, social media. I talk about the contrast between the two cultures I played in and how really getting with the right coach helped me a lot mentally and really bring out my abilities on the court. So it's really just a story about basketball and sports and being an athlete and encouraging athletes to integrate mental training into their routines and also coaches to help athletes do that. The book you can get at billyhanson.net/book. That's probably the best place to get it. And it's also available on Amazon if you search the title.
All right. So we're going to dive right into it. As I read the book, and thank you for sending it over to me so that I could read it prior to us jumping on, there were a lot of things in the book that I could certainly relate to when I think back to my college career and I think back to some of the experiences that you went through. Some of the things and feelings that you shared in the book were things that I could definitely relate to as a college player. And then as I told you before we jumped on, I think there's a lot of parents and players, particularly at the high school level, where the pressure isn't always as great and where the demands on you aren't quite as high, that if I would have read this book as a high school player, I probably would have scoffed at it. Now, it was a long time ago too. So I was a high school player graduating in 1988. So there wasn't really much talk of mental health or any of those things. And I'm a little bit older than you. So clearly I would have had a different experience as a high school player as I read this book than I do now as a 51-year-old looking back and thinking about my own college experience. But there were definitely things that I could relate to, and I'm sure we'll get into some of those as we dive further into the book. Let's start by going back to the beginning when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about the first experiences that you had in youth sports. I know your dad was a big influence on you in that area. So just talk a little bit about your upbringing in Oregon and how you got into sports and then what your sports experience was like as, let's say, a pre-high school athlete.
Yeah, definitely. Real quick, I just want to point out that I think I probably would have scoffed at the book too in high school, which is kind of ironic because, yeah, it took me going through some serious pain in college to find any of that worth looking into or doing, but we'll get to that. So yeah, youth sports, my first experiences with sports. I was very into sports when I was little. You know, I've asked my parents and they said they were of the philosophy that they were going to introduce me to a lot of things and just see what I gravitated towards and then, you know, help me pursue whatever I was passionate about. And I was way into sports from an early age. And yeah, my dad was, I think, really good. He was a very skilled parent. He was my youth coach up until probably about sixth grade was when he stopped coaching me. And he was really good at making sports fun. Like, I didn't feel any undue pressure as a kid. And I think part of the reason why I played so much when I was a kid was because I just loved it. And it was always what I wanted to do. So I was asking my dad to throw me batting practice and go shoot. And, you know, my grandfather was also a high level athlete. He played professional football. And so, you know, he was often around after school to help rebound for me and all that stuff. So yeah, I had a really positive youth sports experience. I was in a small town, kind of a bubble, really good culture of parents volunteering and good leagues. And yeah, I have a great memories of youth sports.
Do you remember parents of some of your friends who maybe took a different approach? Like, did you have anybody
in your life as a friend that their dad was more of the domineering, hey, I'm dragging you to practice. Hey, you're going to do this because if you want to be good, this is what you need to do, as opposed to the opposite track, which is sort of the one that your dad took. And it's one that I've talked about on our podcast that I feel like my dad did the same. And I've tried to do that with my son, where you provide those opportunities and you are there to rebound the ball or play catch if your kid wants to. But if they don't, you're not pushing them over the edge. And as a parent, I can tell you that that is a difficult spot to be in when you're a competitive person and you see that your kid has an opportunity to be good at something. You kind of want to push them and it's hard to hold back. So do you remember anybody that you grew up with that had a parent that had an opposite approach, kind of what your dad took?
Yeah, I do. And yeah, there's some, and that can get pretty dark when parents are putting far too much pressure on a small child too early. And it wasn't like my family was perfect by any means, but there's generally just really positive feeling about sports and encouragement. And I was way into like action figures and Spider-Man too. So that was a whole other phase of my childhood where like my dad painted a big Spider-Man on my wall. So like basically whatever I was into, they were really, you know, pushing me in that direction or helping me move in that direction. My dad and I've talked quite a bit about all of it. And the one thing that we also, you know, he talks about is like, he was so positive and so encouraging that, and so were a lot of my coaches growing up, that I was left potentially, I was very raw when I got to college and played originally for a very old school coach in my first 3 years. So that was almost like a blessing growing up, but also a curse when I got a little bit older. But yeah, to answer your question, I do remember instances of parents taking the opposite approach and the kids feeling like it was their job before it should have felt like that. And I've also noticed that as I've gotten older, just being around the game and seeing different approaches. And yeah, you can get some pretty crazy events going on or just like observing the sideline of a Pop Warner football game. Like it's a weird energy in a lot of cases. So I'm grateful for how my family treated it.
There's definitely a lot of different approaches that you can take. And as you said, I never claim that my approach is the only way or the right way. And there are a lot of times, and there were a lot of times, and I'm sure there will continue to be times where you wonder as a parent, am I doing it right? And that comes down to not just when you're dealing with your kids' sports, but when you're dealing with anything in their life. We're all, as parents, I say, we're just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. You're trying things. You're doing the best you can and trying to figure it out as you go. And you just hope that the decisions that you make, especially as you know your kid better than anybody else, that you make the decisions that are right for them. I think it's interesting that you talked a little bit there about how, because you had such positive coaching, first from your dad and then from coaches that you experienced in multiple sports in high school, that then when you came in contact with a coach who was the opposite and wasn't that positive, rah-rah type of coach, the guy that wasn't going to put his arm around you but was more critical, was less approachable, I think would be a good way to say it, that maybe you hadn't, it's almost like you didn't get the vaccine, right? You didn't get a little bit of a, you didn't get a little bit of a taste. You didn't get a little bit of a taste of that growing up, where you're like, ooh, yeah, I see that. I can handle it. And now I can go back to this sort of safe zone. And then when you got exposed to it, it was quite a shock for you. So let's start with high school. Tell us about your high school athletic experience. You were a basketball player. You played baseball. Just tell us a little bit about some of the things that you appreciated about the coaches that you had, especially now looking back where you have maybe a little bit more perspective.
Yeah. So pretty great high school experience, with the only exception to that being very stressful recruiting. That was a huge stress for me and for my family. But just in terms of on the court and on the field, you know, I had quite a bit of success early on. I kind of swung varsity my freshman year in basketball and got some minutes at the varsity level. Played baseball. I was on JV2 and then made varsity in both my sophomore year and was, you know, an impact player pretty early. And we had a lot of success as a team in baseball and basketball my sophomore year. We played in a state championship game my sophomore baseball season. and were in the hunt for the state tournament in basketball, which was, we had a very, you know, high powered baseball program, not as quite as good at basketball. So that would have been a huge deal. We didn't quite make it. And then in baseball, we kept staying in the hunt for state championships, never quite won one. Basketball, we were not quite as talented junior and senior season. So I had the ball in my hands the whole game, the whole season, and, you know, scored a lot of points, took a ton of shots, and was doing a lot on the court. Yeah, my basketball coach was great. He was a really good person, taught me a lot about sports, but also just a good influence for me as I was growing into being a man. My baseball coach, him and I are still in close contact, and he was remarkable. Just probably, you know, up there with the best coaches I've ever had, just in terms of, and he wasn't a softy. Like, he was intense, but also just very positive and encouraging, and he helped make the game fun. And he really poured his heart and soul into it. Now I really appreciate just how much time he put into, you know, summer hitting and long practices and all the film that he watched with us and stuff. Like, you don't really realize as a kid that, you know, he's not getting paid for all that. And so that's a pretty big sacrifice that he was making.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, no, I'm really grateful for my high school coaches and the experience I had.
When you think back to those times, what's a memory that stands out for you? Could be in the locker room, could be on the field, could be on the court. Just if you had to summarize your high school experience with one particular memory, what stands out to you?
Yeah, good question. The first thing that comes to mind is I hit a game winner in my junior season that it was a pretty lucky shot, honestly. It was like a broken play where we screwed up the play, and then I just caught a pass and chucked up a fadeaway falling out of bounds against our rivals. And it went in, and it was a big pandemonium celebration. And there was also a big rivalry that year between my best friend, who was the quarterback of the football team, who was in attendance. And there was like a bunch of tension between the football players who were watching. So you know how it can get in high school sports. Like, it's, you know, that's the kind of the most raucous atmosphere that I've been in. And so, yeah, make a big shot to win the game and have our fans storm their courts. And that was the game that put us in the playoffs. I guess that's the moment that stuck out to me in high school. Yeah.
You had a lot of early success. And as a kid growing up, obviously you have aspirations of playing one of your sports or maybe both of your sports, in your case, at the college level. And you mentioned a little bit earlier that recruiting process was stressful. And I've told my recruiting story a couple times on the podcast, but basically for me, I had no idea. And this is pre-internet and nobody knew anything. My parents didn't know anything. My high school coach really had never had a player that was capable of playing at the level that I was playing, and I knew nothing. So I was basically left in the dark, where the school that I ended up going to asked me to come down for an official visit. I think it was after my junior year, and I told them no because I was still waiting for Duke and Ohio State and North Carolina to call me. And I had no idea that that was, at that point, completely unrealistic. I had no clue. And so I ended up ended up working out for me, and I ended up in a good place that fit who I was, and it all worked out, but not because of any good decisions or things that I went through. I have no good advice for anybody going through the recruiting process in terms of my own story. Probably do the opposite of whatever I did. I just happened to get lucky. So for you, it sounds like it was at least something similar, where you had an expectation of what you thought was going to happen. And when that started not to happen, suddenly you had to look in the mirror and start to figure out, okay, what's going on? Why isn't it happening? And then what am I going to do? So tell the story of where you were recruiting wise and just what some of the things are that you went through with your family.
Yeah. So being, you know, I pretty much made success in athletics a big part of my identity, right? I was the kid who didn't go to the party because I was going to be up early training. I was, you know, that was kind of who I was a successful athlete, right? And so part of me, whether I knew it or not at the time, I think felt like if it didn't pay off in something special, like some cool scholarship or something, then what was it all for? Like, well, who was I at that point? Right. Like, it had to be something cool. And for the longest time I was, you know, growing up, I was going pro, and then slowly, you know, reality kind of set my expectations into place, over time. The other thing is, growing up in a small town, you don't quite understand how good people are across the country. And so even though you're dominating in, you know, 5A Southern Oregon, that you've no clue the kind of talent in LA and Texas and Arizona and like all of these places, right? So I, you know, my dad and I sent a highlight tape out to probably 50 Division Ones, some high majors, some mid majors, and it was just me hitting a bunch of threes from all over the court, deep threes, and got a bunch of attention back quickly. And at that time, I think I'm probably 16 and I don't understand much about anything. So I go and tell everyone, like, hey, oh my God, Davison's talking to me, like Portland, like all of the, you know, Air Force. And just because I'm stoked, right? I want to be, that's, I think I'm I thought at that point offers were coming after all the letters, right? And then pretty much all of them asked for, they said, Billy, really interested in you in our program, please send full game tape. And so we put together a tape where I had like 36 points and let it come back. And I was pretty confident when I sent the send button because it was a great game, and just pretty much crickets after that. Like nobody got back to me, and we sent follow-ups and they all said, you know, thank you, Billy. I think you're going to have a successful career, but you're not a great fit for our program at this time. And in hindsight, it was obvious that, you know, I was a good shooter, but wasn't a good enough guard to play at that level. And I shouldn't have been recruited at that level, right? But that was really hard because then I'm answering questions around the community of like, well, what's Air Force saying now and where are you going to go? So that was a tough year because I didn't have any offers until after the spring of my senior season. So, yeah, just going through that, having the kind of identity problem of feeling like all of this had to pay off in some way, all of the parties I've missed, all of the time I put into this, if it doesn't turn into a scholarship, then why did I do it? That was kind of the feeling I had. And it was pretty stressful. And then, like you said, no one in the family had gone through it. So it's like, we didn't know who we should be aiming for, how we should be going about it. And it was a very stressful time.
It's a challenge when you don't have anybody sort of in your circle that can help you and point you in the right direction and say, hey, this is what you should be doing, or this is who you should be talking to, or this is the level that you should be shooting for, that you should be trying to get into contact with coaches from Division II or Division III or NAI or whatever it is. And it's challenging. And as you said, when you start and you have your identity tied up in, I'm a basketball player or I'm an athlete, and I think in a lot of ways, I was similar. I wanted to be a Division I basketball player, and I was probably similar to you in that I was not, as Coach Jason will attest, I was not the greatest athlete when you think of athlete in terms of...
Hey man, his vertical is so good, Billy. I'm telling you, you should see him. At his age, he can really get that net. He's really good.
I'm good. I can get up. I can still get up and get the net. So I was never that type of jump high, run fast athlete. Maybe run long. Endurance was probably something that I was pretty good at. But as I was going up and playing on the playgrounds and playing in what limited, it wasn't even called AAU basketball, but just summer basketball back then. And I saw a bunch of the guys that I played against all the time that I felt like I was as good or better than. And many of them signed before their senior season. And just like you, I went through my entire senior season and didn't have an offer. But I think unlike you, I was probably still blissfully unaware that offers weren't coming. It was only when my season ended and I didn't have anything that I called back up the program at Kent State where I had declined the paid visit and said, hey, are you still interested? And they're like, well, maybe. And it turned out that a kid transferred and they had one scholarship, and I was the seventh scholarship freshman in a class of seven and just happened to get lucky and got that opportunity. But when I signed with Kent, I was talking to two other Division I schools, and talking means I didn't have an offer. They were just still kind of keeping me hanging around, I'm sure, as they were waiting to see if
whoever they were really targeting was going to sign with them. And then maybe I would be a fallback option in that case. And so ended up getting the opportunity. But to your point, and I've had this conversation a few times with lots of coaches about trying to find the right fit for you. And maybe it's Division III or maybe it's Division II or whatever it was. And for me, it was never any of those things. It could have been any Division I school and I would have signed simply for this fact of what you talked about. Like, that was kind of who I was. I saw the guys that I played with all the time or against all the time that I thought I'm as good as them. It was kind of that Division I or bust mentality that we talk about, and we try to, I think, aim kids away from that. But that's certainly who I was at that time. And it's just, when you don't know better, you can end up making some bad decisions. And for me, luckily, I ended up in a place that fit. And I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit more as we get into your experience as well. So tell us a little bit about how you ended up resetting your expectations and then what that led you to.
Yeah. So I finally worked with a recruiting service that was really helpful. They helped organize my game plan. The other thing that made it difficult was I was probably equally as good at both baseball and basketball. And I had probably a glaring deficiency in both. In baseball, it was arm strength. And basketball, it was athleticism and lateral quickness. Things that really just inhibited me from being a kind of a complete player that could have gone D1 or whatever. So they helped me, after they saw the kind of interest that I had gotten already, they helped me target more Division II schools, NAIAs. And I had quite a bit of interest, and set up some visits for the spring of my senior season. And my first visit was to Regis University in Denver. And me and my dad went out there, and we were pretty blown away by the experience there. It was a basketball visit, and the coach offered a full scholarship, and it was a beautiful campus, and we loved Denver. And then the one problem there was that I was going to have to give up baseball, which I wasn't quite sure I was ready to do. And so the basketball coach met with the baseball coach, and he looked at all my stuff, my recruiting profile, and he offered me a roster position. So as a walk-on, a walk-on spot on the team. So at that point, I got back and I had these other visits scheduled, and I was so excited that we just signed the papers. I just took the first one, and we were on our way to Regis and canceled the other visits. And part of that, I think, was just impatience with... I was actually in a terrible hitting slump senior year, worst of my career. And it's interesting because as soon as I signed, I started hitting good again. It was just this load off my back of like, okay, I'm going somewhere in college to play. Thank God I can, you know, relax and enjoy the rest of my senior year and my summer and, you know, have a good time with my friends.
So you get there, and this is a story I love from the book, that you get there for the first time and your coach, Coach Daniels, meets you and he says, hey, you want to go and get some shooting in before we check out the cafeteria? Relay what you said to him and then sort of how you were feeling in your mind at that moment.
Yeah. So throughout my senior year, this was already kind of happening in a weird way. I didn't shoot a great percentage senior year. There was some weird hitch in my shot where my left hand was too involved with my shot. And I didn't really realize at the time, but over time, I realized that that was getting worse with nervousness or anxiety. And when I first walked onto the Regis campus, he asked if you wanted to go shoot, like right when I got there, and I immediately got tense and just, I probably couldn't have articulated it this way at the time, but I think it was a level of imposter syndrome of, oh my God, he's going to realize that he made a mistake in giving me the scholarship if we go shoot right now, because I advertised myself as this lights out shooter. And I was pretty much a lights out shooter sophomore, junior in high school, but haven't been for about a year. And he's going to realize that I'm not, that he made a mistake. And so I told him, no, like, I just want to get settled in first. And that was kind of the first instance of me, you know, trying in a weird way, I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but trying not to play or shoot in front of my coaches as much as I could, which is, sounds crazy, I know, because that is something you're going to have to do if you're on a basketball team. But yeah, as I've come to talk to other athletes, that's actually more common than you might think, is that level of imposter syndrome when you show up on campus.
I think everybody has that to some degree in whatever, it could be a different aspect of their life than sports for somebody who's out there listening and you're trying to set yourself up as an expert, or you wonder, man, they're really paying me to do this job. I don't really know what I'm doing. Sometimes I get imposter syndrome as a parent, and I think about myself and I'm like, man, I'm 51 years old and I'm like a giant kid. I know my dad had it way more together than I did. And it just, which he may have or he may not have, but I always feel like I'm just kind of a big goofy kid still. And I know I'm not. I have three kids and I've had a job for 27 years or whatever it is. But nonetheless, there's a part of you that still feels like
he is goofy though. He is goofy though.
I'm not really an adult, right, Jason? I mean, it's just like you try to do things and stay young and whatever, but there's a part of you that's like, man, I'm not sure I belong at this spot. And I can understand where you're coming from. And then the next thing that happens to you is you find out a little bit about your teammates and that there's sort of a drinking culture on the team at Regis. So talk a little bit about how that affected you, how it started you down a path. You mentioned earlier that you were a kid that didn't drink, didn't party, stayed away from that because it sort of contrasted with your view of yourself as an athlete. So just talk about how you handled that and what that meant to you as you went through your college career.
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, those teammates that I had early on at Regis, I love them. They're really good people. And I just want to start there. I'm not trying to talk bad about them as people.
For sure. Absolutely.
But there was a very heavy drinking culture within the team. And this is, of course, I don't know that because I'm just showing up. I thought that's just how it was in college. But, you know, it was the team hadn't had success the last few years. And there was, I think, kind of a culture of building in this defense mechanism of, well, yeah, we suck, but we get to party. And at least we're in Denver and these other people we're playing are in Gunnison, even though they're kicking our ass, you know, we have a better experience. It was kind of this strange attitude. And there definitely was an expectation within the social leaders on the team that you were going to show up on time to the pregame and you were going to get really drunk on weekends. And so it was generally in the preseason, every Friday, Saturday, and then during the season, we had games Friday, Saturday, so Saturday nights, and then even some of the players would go out Friday in between games, which is horrible. You know, that's just crazy. And so I, of course, wanted to fit in, wanted to be liked by the upperclassmen, and I think that the drinking became kind of a release from the discomfort and anxiety I was feeling throughout the week, but ultimately contributed to it long-term. I just, you know, by midway freshman year, I felt completely worn down physically and mentally. And I think a lot of that had to do with the partying. And I think there's something to be said about making some mistakes when you're young, and I'm not completely anti-drinking or anti-partying. I think for me, it was just the repeated damage of weekend after weekend after weekend that did it to me, right? If I would have done that just in the preseason to explore a little bit or once in a while, I don't think it would have been as unhealthy as it was, if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. And I think that there's a fine line there, right? When you think about high school students, when you think about college students, the vast majority of them are going to experiment to some degree. And I was a kid that I was just like you in high school, and I continued with that philosophy during college. I was lucky enough that there wasn't a pervasive culture of that. Not to say that teammates weren't drinking, because certainly they were, but I had one teammate that I lived with, and he and I, well, actually I was lucky because my freshman year, I had two roommates from the team. One was just like me, didn't drink. The other one did. The one that didn't, he and I got to be real close. And that was a year that I wasn't playing very much, but I had somebody to hang out with no matter what. Even if you go out to a bar or a club, he and I could stand there and drink our waters or drink a soda or whatever. And I'd have somebody. And then he transferred after my freshman year and then ended up living with another guy who was another kid who didn't drink on our team. So it was sort of easy for me from that standpoint, because I had somebody there that was with me. But I could certainly see that if you didn't have somebody there with you who was supporting that, it would have been a lot more challenging, I think, for me to pull that off. And then you combine that, and this is something that I think I really related to, that you talked about a lot was just the stress you felt from the coaching style and just the shift from a high school environment where sports are fun and you're clearly the best player to an environment where maybe your coaching staff isn't quite as supportive, where maybe practices aren't quite as fun, where it's maybe more of a business relationship. And then your level of enthusiasm for practice and being a college basketball player sort of ebbs and flows. So Todd, I don't know which one of those things you want to touch on, but just as you got into your freshman year, how did your attitude towards the game of basketball and being a college basketball player change from what you thought it would be from that first moment you stepped on campus?
Yeah. So yeah, first, just I think that while the culture I got into in college wasn't for me in many ways, I know there are a lot of athletes who are in much far more destructive ones than I was in. You know, my head coach was very old school. He was a yeller. He was really intense, really critical, but also I have a lot of respect for him as a person, and he was good to me off the court, and he definitely cared about me. And so I know that there are players in worse situations than I was in. And I still, you know, admire him in many ways. The assistant coaches were more than supportive. They gave me every opportunity. I think a lot of it had to do with the basketball fit of I was thrown in the fire because the team wasn't good the previous few years. They invested in their new talent, right? And so I think in hindsight, I probably could have benefited from a red shirt or a year not playing too much and developing, but I got thrown out there. I wrote a bit about this in the book too, of how I was in high school. I was, you know, 6'3", which in the Southern Sky Conference is pretty tall. So I could often hide on defense and guard forwards or bigs. And then getting to college and having to guard these really quick, strong, athletic guards, I was really bad on defense, and I never got good, but I was just abysmal when I got there. And so I think a lot of it just had to do with the struggles on the court. I wasn't shooting well. I was getting more and more. I was losing confidence over time. I was getting bullied in the paint by bigger, stronger, faster guards. And yeah, it's kind of hard to remember how my attitude was throughout freshman year. It was not good. It was kind of trying to get to the weekend and get through the season. And then I was worried about baseball coming in the spring because I hadn't touched a bat in months. So it just was generally an unhappy time that actually got worse my sophomore year.
When did you start to recognize that anxiety or feel? There's something that you say in the book that about being the basketball felt unnatural in your hands, which for a kid like you who grew up with the game, who grew up with athletics, basically with some kind of ball in your hands from the time I'm sure you were 2-3 years old, to say that the ball felt unnatural in your hands, I think it's hard for somebody who hasn't experienced that to know what that meant or what that felt like. So when do you remember that feeling creeping over you for the first time?
Yeah, it was definitely present freshman year, especially towards the end. But I think it really got to its lowest point during my sophomore season. So after having a not a great baseball season either, I decided that if I'm going to underperform in both of these, I need to pick one because I'm on scholarship for basketball. So I had to quit baseball, focus on basketball, and I put a ton of pressure on myself leading up to my sophomore season. I was desperate to get back on track and get my career going again. And I think my solution to my problems was misguided at that time. It was basically just a brute force approach to, like, if my teammates are going to get 100 shots up a day, I'm going to get 500. If they're going to run a mile a day, I'm going to run 4 miles. And that was something I was pretty good at, is like working hard and pushing through pain. But at that point in my life, it wasn't what I needed. It would have actually helped me to relax a little bit, I think. But so anyway, I get to my sophomore season and I start out shooting poorly again, and I can sense the disappointment from the coaching staff. And that's when it really started. It was, and that was, yeah, the best way I could describe it was like, for the first time in my life, the ball didn't feel right in my hands. And I couldn't even get it to where it felt like I could shoot it cleanly. And it was, the ball was pulling off my guide hand. I was, basically every shot in practice, I was just hoping it wasn't going to be an air ball. And I was relieved when I hit the rim, even if it was a miss. And free throws were especially dreadful because you're not supposed to air ball those, right? and so it's, yeah. And then, you know, being recruited as a shooter and then losing the skills that I took for granted as like a seventh grader, right? I could knock down free throws in my sleep in seventh grade. And now I can't, I'm shooting less than 50% in practice and not playing in games. And I would still do these crazy kind of pseudo heroic attempts to get out of my slump where I would go to the gym at 9:30 at night with practice coming up in the morning, trying, you know, going to shoot my way. I'm going to see enough shots go through the hoop to get out of this slump, which is, you know, generally probably a good thing for a lot of players to just shoot your way out of it. But for me, it was just adding to the stress and pressure. And yeah, it just kind of spiraled into this feeling of the skills that I'd grown up taking for granted just all of a sudden were gone for me as a sophomore in college.
Did any of your coaches recognize that and have a conversation with you at any point?
Yeah. The graduate assistant who, as you guys probably know, there's a, you know, the graduate assistant can be a little bit more friendly with players, like on a friendship level, then as you move up the ranks, and it's not inappropriate, right? So he would like eat lunch with me, and he had an intuitive understanding of what I was going through and tried to help me, tried to encourage me. He would go shoot with me. The assistant, Coach Daniels, who recruited me, was very supportive and tried to help me out. So yeah, I knew that everybody knew, and my head coach was just, you know, generally disappointed that I wasn't playing well. And I, you know, I think I probably brought as a defense mechanism, I brought not the best attitude to the gym, which also kind of offended my coach. So yeah, it got to a pretty bad space, and none of them ever treated me with any real disrespect or anything bad, but it was just, so yeah, to answer your question, yes, they did know, and they did try to talk to me, especially the graduate assistant, Steve Ledesma. He could definitely feel my pain a little bit, it seemed like, and work with me. Yeah.
That's a tough situation. And Jason, I'm going to tell a story here on the podcast that I've never told it on the podcast, and I haven't really told it to a ton of people.
I'm excited. Every time you bust this out, Billy, he says, you know, I've known Mike since I was 7 or 8. So I think I know a lot of his stories, but I get excited whenever he says this. So,
you got hundreds of podcasts. So an original, that's pretty special.
Yeah, this is an original. So it relates completely to your story. So as a high school player, I shot, I believe for my high school career, I probably shot 88% from the line as a high school free throw shooter. And I scored a lot of points. So I got to the line a lot. And when I got to college, my freshman year, I didn't play very much. So I didn't get to the line very much my first year because I played like 4 minutes a game. And then my sophomore year, we had a really good team. And I think we finished 21-8, I believe. And I was a starter on that team. And for the first 4/5 of the season, I was shooting, and I'm actually looking at my statistics right now. So for the season from the free throw line as a sophomore, I shot 49 for 66, so 74%. So not compared to what I was like in high school, obviously not very good. But at one point in that season, I was 48 for 56, so I went 1 for my last 10. So that experience that you had of the ball feeling unnatural in your hand with about, I can't remember how many games there was to go in my season, maybe 7, 8, 9. I can't even remember. But we used to have to, at the end of practice, we would have to make 5 swishes before we could leave practice. And I started shooting the ball and trying to aim it, to swish it. Somehow all of a sudden, my ability to shoot free throws was completely gone. Now, Jason and I have talked about Ben Simmons and how he doesn't want to shoot and how he's afraid to go to the free throw line. And I got to that point when I was a sophomore where in practice we would do little free throw shooting games like on our day before game practice. And I would be, to your point, just like you described of, I just don't want to shoot an air ball. If this ball hits the rim, I'm going to be ecstatic. And it was the most strange and bizarre thing. Kind of think back to like the Steve Sachs or the Chuck Knobloch, the guy, the Rick Ankiels of baseball that can't throw the ball. And all of a sudden I couldn't shoot. So I had to go back. And what I did was I tried to change my routine. So I previously had a routine where I would take 3 dribbles and then I'd take this breath and then I'd reset and then I'd take the shot. And that routine, anytime I did that, I then associated that with me not being able to get the ball anywhere near the basket. And so my last, whatever, 6, 7, 8 games, it didn't really affect me anywhere else on the floor. I mean, I didn't really want to get fouled, but it wasn't like the rest of my performance went completely in the tank. I just didn't want to go to the free throw line. And so then I spent that whole summer, none of my coaches ever said anything to me about it in terms of, hey, what's happening? Like, they looked at things with my mechanics, not with my mental performance. So it was very strange. And then I
But do you think that they, sorry to interrupt you, do you think
go for it.
Was it to the point where your teammates and coaches knew something was up, or was it such a short period that you kind of just went under the radar?
Oh, I think they knew. I don't think that. So I actually had dinner with my assistant coach he's probably in his mid 70s. This was a couple months ago. And in the course of us talking, he's like, man, he goes, I remember when you just completely just lost the ability to shoot, to shoot a free throw. But I'm like, well, did you talk about it? Was there any thought of, hey, let's see what we can do to get Mike out of this thing? What can, you know, how can we do it? And so when you described like that anxiety of wanting, of going up there, that's how I felt. So I was one of my last 10 as a sophomore. Then I go into my junior year. So all summer, obviously, I'm working on this. I mean, to your point about having an identity, like my identity was Mike's going to make free throws. I mean, you shoot 88, 89% as a high school player. You're not probably used to missing too many. So as a junior, I would get to the line and I would have this feeling again of it being unnatural, the ball, that was a great way to describe it. It just didn't feel like, this is something I had done literally every day since I was probably 8, 9 years old. I shot 100 free throws. Now I'm exaggerating. I'm sure it wasn't every day, but there were a lot of days of my life where I shot 100 free throws. And every time I would go to the line, I would feel that anxiety. And as a junior, I shot 71% from the line. So it wasn't completely debilitating. It didn't take me completely out of who I was, but I was certainly a different player that didn't want to go to the line as much. I had a bigger role as a junior than I did as a sophomore, and I shot 9 less free throws, probably because I didn't want to go to the basket as hard. And then as a senior, I somehow managed to shoot 82%, which is probably the thing that I'm most proud of maybe in my career that I really haven't shared with anybody, was that I kind of was able to overcome it. But I will tell you that even today, there are still moments where I think about, "Ooh, I'm going to go shoot a free throw," and I can still get that feeling. Now, I've never talked to a sports psychologist. I've never done any meditation because obviously my career is long since over. So my ability to knock down clutch free throws at this point probably isn't that important. But it's definitely something that when I read your book and I heard about those experiences that you went through, it definitely brought me back to a time where I felt that same anxiety. And unlike you, which we'll talk about in a second, I sort of was left to fend for myself. And like I said, coaches talked to me a little bit about mechanics. As I was a kid who I thumbed the ball with my guide hand. So they try to look at it and see, well, maybe that's what's causing it. And I knew that that had nothing to do with it. My shot hadn't changed at all from a physical standpoint. It was all strictly me getting to the line and just tensing up and feeling like I couldn't just let it flow. And I know you talk a lot about the flow state in the book. So that's my story. I didn't mean to interrupt your story.
No, that's interesting.
But I definitely felt like there was a lot of things there that I related to.
It gives me lots of ammunition on NBA pods when Mike makes fun of Ben Simmons. I'm really excited to have that. So thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
Well, see, this is why I always say I know how hard it is to overcome, because I was able
and
to.
You can see it. You can see it in Ben Simmons.
For sure.
You can put yourself there. Like when I watch him, I was in that playoff series. When he was getting trashed by the media and stuff, I was like, man, this guy's going through it. He's having a tough time, you know?
And you just, I don't know what it was that allowed me to work my way through it. But I never got completely through it. I never got back to that 88, 89. I never felt the same way. Like if you'd have told me when I was at the beginning of my sophomore year or when I was in high school that I would ever step to a free throw line and not feel like that ball 100% was going to go in. Now, obviously I missed some, but I never felt like that ball wasn't going to go in. If you'd have told me I was ever going to lose that feeling, I would have told you were crazy. And, you know, at some point I did. But like I said, one of my proudest moments is that I was able to overcome that, because look at the guys who have lost careers, baseball, golf, there's basketball guys, Simmons, who knows what's going to happen here with him. Just to be able to overcome that, I just, it sounds silly to say that, you know, I'm proud that I was bad for a while and was somehow able to become at least a little bit better and not get back to the level that I had been before. But I definitely, as I read it, I heard and felt the things that you were feeling. So that was really interesting for me. And I really enjoyed reading it, because a lot of the feelings that you were describing were things that I could completely, completely relate to. So I'll let you continue with your part of the journey and how you started to go about overcoming that. Because my advice for overcoming it isn't very good, which is just kind of struggle along in your own head and try to figure it out, which I didn't have any method to my madness, nor did I have any real outside help. So.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating to hear your story. And I've been surprised, actually, as I started to share what I went through and write about it, talk about it, that there's a lot more athletes out there than you'd think who go through something like that in their career, you know, to varying degrees. Not many sink to the depths of, you know, like Markel Fultz, but there are quite, you know, many athletes can relate to that, it seems like. So it was interesting to hear your story. As far as recovering, you know, I was to the point where I was ready to quit. And I, my parents were encouraging me to stick it out, my grandparents, and I'm glad they did that, just because at that point, I'm not going to get a scholarship anywhere else, having such poor stats for the first two seasons, right? And I finally decided to see a sports psychologist on campus. I don't remember why I ended up doing that, but I remember not telling anyone, not wanting any. That's the first question I asked her, was like, my coaches aren't going to know I'm here, right? My teammates aren't going to know I'm here. And she said, no, if I see you on campus, I won't look at you. I won't say hi. Like, we'll just make this private. And I appreciated that. And she was really great. Like, she was a really gentle, but wise and serious person who was obviously really good at what she does. And she, you know, after talking to me, basically put those words on it, which I had never even thought about. It was like, you're suffering from really bad performance anxiety and you have depression off the court. And that is, growing up as a happy kid, that was weird to hear, because I never thought of myself as someone who experienced any of that. But I thought she was right. And as one of the main, you know, we did quite a few things, but the primary remedy that she suggested was basic mindfulness meditation. And I was a bit of a tough sell at first on that, because I had associated meditation to so many other cultural baggage. But she encouraged me to try it. And I started to practice with her in her office. And then she got me some audio from UCLA to do on my own. And it's, you know, I could feel even immediately, I could feel right away that there was something to it. It didn't quite help that much during my sophomore year because it was such a, you know, whirlwind of despair and anxiety. I was literally just every day that I got through practice without embarrassing myself was a success. And when I was in games, I just didn't want to play. As long as the score stayed close, I knew coach wouldn't put me in the game. If we were up by a lot or down by a lot, I was going in. And so I would root for whoever was behind from the bench, which is completely shameful, but I'm just being honest. Like, you know, it's a horrible place to be in, but that's the truth. And so I made it through my sophomore season, and then she stayed in contact with me into the off season. And that's when I really gained a little bit of momentum with the meditation stuff. And I practiced throughout my junior season. And ultimately it was one of the variables that helped me recover. I don't try to simplify it so much that like, okay, meditation saved the whole thing, but I definitely think it played a crucial role.
What did meditation look like for you? So what did you start out doing? What did she have you start out with? And then how did it evolve, and how maybe has it evolved in your life where you are now?
Yeah. So started out with just following the breath every time, you know, feeling the inhalation, feeling the exhalation, maybe even counting the breaths as a way to stay anchored. Every time you notice your mind run away, which is very often, you just gently bring your attention back to the breath. And that's just a simple way to reframe. It was this really, the thing that I really appreciated about it was it was a different mental strategy than I had been accustomed to. What it was before was this kind of macho-ish self-talk of watching motivational YouTube videos, trying to amp yourself up. You know, today you're not going to be nervous. Today you're going to play like you know how to play. But it was all very surfacey kind of bullshit. Like, it didn't really help me. And I actually think that kind of thing made it worse. It was basically just confirming in my own mind that I didn't actually believe in myself, all of that stuff I was doing. And I know some athletes have success with different things. So I'm not saying my way is the only way, but for me, it didn't work. So with meditation, it was instead of wrestling with the anxiety or trying to think my way out of it or talk myself out of it, it was just, okay, every time you notice this, feel the sensations clearly, feel them in your chest, feel them in your face, feel them in your hands, and then return your attention to the breath and to your feet on the floor and to the next play. And so after following the breath, she would put me through these exercises of, I would actually put myself in the gym mentally, maybe at the free throw line with my coach watching. And even just the thought of it would trigger some kind of muted version of the discomfort that I felt on the floor. And so I could practice, okay, you're feeling, where do you feel the anxiety physically? And just that little shift of putting your attention on the physical sensations goes a long way in terms of cutting through their power. It's like, rather than being in the storm, you're kind of stepping out of it and watching it just for a second, right? And so we practiced those things. We also just did some simple visualization of visualizing myself making free throws or making jump shots. And that was a really clear indication that what I was going through was mental, because I remember being in her office and every time I tried to play the movie in my mind of a perfect free throw, the image in my mind would, without fail, it would pull off my left hand and I would miss off the front rim. And so I couldn't even see it in my mind. Like, that's how deep it was. And so that was what first convinced me that, okay, this really is a mental issue. Like, it's not mechanical. This is something going on psychologically, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I mean, I knew right away that it was something psychological as opposed to something physical when that was happening for me. And I think I probably, again, I look back on it and I'm not sure really how I got through it. I don't remember doing much except trying to beat down those feelings. That's probably what I remember most, is saying to myself, this can't be what's happening to me. It can't, how can this be what I'm doing? I'm not the person standing here doing this. And I wish I had a more scientific approach. I wish I had better advice. I wish I had a way that maybe if somebody had been able to get to me and gotten me some help in a different way, that maybe I would have been able to overcome it faster. And who knows, maybe I would have been able to get back to the level that I got. And it's just, it's interesting to think about those experiences, because as you said, we hear about some of those really high profile people that have difficulty. And yet I'm sure that I wasn't the only one that it happened to. You weren't the only one that it happened to. And some guys are able to overcome it and other people are not able to overcome it. And I think part of it is just how you go about and what your approach is and how the support group that you have around you. And you had something that in your senior year probably helped as well, because you had a new coach come in that reset your opportunity, reset the environment, and that at least allowed you maybe to sort of change the way that you were viewing things. And sort of, I look at it as sort of the same way that I changed my free throw routine. So I got out of what was triggering me before and tried to do it a different way. And that definitely helped me. And I think that's the one thing that even now, if I go back and think about, man, I used to do these three dribbles and then this breath and shoot it. And that was the way I was, you know, the best foul shooter I've ever been in my career. And then now I'm doing it this way. And it's just interesting the way your mind plays tricks on you. And sometimes you have to try to trick it. I felt like sometimes I had to try to trick it back. Like, let's trick it back to what it was before. So.
Yeah. And I think the meditation, it was something that, and that's something I try to argue now, is I think it's become something that is sold as kind of a quick fix solution. And it's really not. It's something that the real fruit of the practice comes from, just like anything in sports. Like if you want to get good at ball handling, you've got to do it consistently over a long period of time. I feel the same way about meditation. You're not going to do really hard 1 hour long ball handling drill one day and then be a transformed ball handler, right? And so luckily my sports psychologist helped me persist, encouraged me to keep going. And then I kept practicing throughout my junior season and things were just generally better. I didn't have a great season junior year, but I was no longer miserable and I was still battling with some of the same issues, but it wasn't so consuming as it was sophomore year. And I actually finished my junior season with two good games, the last two games of the season. I played a lot. I scored. I felt more comfortable on the court than I had felt in a long time. And then, so I was getting better already. I practiced really hard again in the summer and then between junior and senior season. And then when the new coaching staff came in, it was like this brand new, fresh start for me to kind of start over.
And how did that help you when you think back to that? Do you think you would have continued to have the same, I don't know if breakthrough is probably not the right word, but the same progress would have continued? Or do you think the new coaching staff maybe accelerated it and made it easier when you look back on that?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it had to do with just the practicalities of basketball. Because yes, I would have kept meditating. It would have been fine. I would have kept improving, I think. But just it was such a better fit for me when Coach Bergeson came in. And one of the first things that he said to me early on in an open gym was, I had gone to the hoop a couple times and gotten my shot blocked or missed a floater or something. And he took me to his office and he said, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to drive to the hoop anymore unless it's like a wide open fast break. And it's a little bit hard to hear because I'd spent so much time working on everything guard play, right? But he said, we want you, when you catch the ball, you can either shoot, shot fake, or pass and then move the offense. And that alone was so transformative for me on the court that I was put in position to do what I was good at, right? And he would blow the whistle and stop practice and yell at me if I didn't take a semi-contested shot. So it was very, you know, he was really pushing me I think he could see that I was a good shooter. I just needed a little push probably, right? He also had me shooting from deep, which I wasn't allowed to do with my previous coach. Deep three-pointers were a terrible shot in the first program. Now I was being encouraged, like, you know, move back. We know you can shoot it from out there. You were doing it a little bit in high school, but I want you to practice deep threes to spread the offense. And I actually got really comfortable out there with less of a contest. I felt really good stepping back a little bit. And then also just the culture of, you know, consistency, toughness were really valued and praised. So like, I felt like if I showed up to practice and I worked really hard and I brought energy and toughness, I was going to get rewarded for it with praise from the coaching staff and, you know, opportunities for playing time. And so I think it was, yes, the culmination of this mindfulness, meditation, visualization work that I've been doing paired with finding a really good cultural fit and an opportunity to do what I was good at on the court that really made the difference.
Yeah, it's amazing how much the right fit makes a difference. And I know I speak about my career all the time, and my coach was definitely old school, was definitely critical in a lot of ways. I could visualize your coach and my coach being similar without having seen or experienced what you went through. Just hearing some of the descriptions were definitely, I think, brought back to life some of the ways that I felt like I was coached. And in a lot of ways, like I've said a couple times, I ended up in the right place for me in that my coach valued some of the things that I was able to bring to the table, and therefore I got lots of opportunities to play. I started every game as a sophomore, as a junior, and as a senior. So despite whatever difficulties I was going through, I continued to be able to be out on the court and continue to play. My freshman year was by far my toughest year when you go from being a high school player to being a college player who's not playing very much, and you got to go through and the grind of practice every day. And I always laugh when I think about practice, especially as a freshman. There was, you and Jason may be too young to even remember this, but there was a show called The Dick Van Dyke Show that was on reruns, and that show would play practice at 3 o'clock, and every day that show would come on like from 2 to 2:30, and it had a very distinctive
theme
song.
Come on, I know
song.
I'm young, Mike, but I know the Dick Van Dyke Show. Jeez, all right,
but
Louise.
So it had a very distinctive theme song, and so whenever that theme song would come on, you get like this PTSD reaction of like, oh, I got to, it's time for practice. And I mean, I was a kid who loved basketball, and I continue to love basketball, but there were definitely moments throughout my college career where you were like, God, this practice, it's just not fun. And I was a kid who, again, after that freshman year, I started every game. I think I averaged 37 minutes a game for my career. So when I was playing, I almost never came off the floor. But even for me, so a kid who loved basketball, a kid who was playing all the time, there were moments where it was really difficult. And obviously, I had the thing with the free throws that I described. And I can only imagine what it's like for somebody who isn't having all the positive feedback and success that I had. Man, if I would have gone through 4 years that were similar to my freshman year, either in terms of minutes or just if I hadn't been able to play well or wasn't starting or was only getting spot minutes, to go through that grind every single day would have been really, really, really difficult. And I give anybody who could do that a lot of credit for figuring out a way to make it through that. And because it does take a lot of mental strength and commitment to be able to go through something that's difficult, especially when you're not getting the reward that maybe you envisioned when you started.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of time and energy and effort and sacrifice to put in when the thing that you're sacrificing all that for is what's making you miserable, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely. That's a very good way to put it. And you're on scholarship, right? So you're going to school for free, which adds a whole nother element to it. You had people, I'm sure, back in your hometown that were asking you, talking to you, wondering about you. If you had come back into town after a year or two and had given up your scholarship and gone somewhere else to school, you probably would have had to answer a lot of questions that probably wouldn't have enjoyed answering those questions. I'm guessing probably could have, but she probably wouldn't have enjoyed answering those questions that much. So there's this, there's that underlying pressure that you put on yourself, but then there's also this weight of expectations from other people. What were the conversations like with your dad during those 4 years? I'm just curious, what did you guys talk about? How much of it, the struggle, did you share with your dad? How much did you try to maybe keep it to yourself and say, well, the less people that figure this out about me, the better? Just where was that relationship and what were the conversations like?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, my parents have, when they read my book, they had a hard time with it. They, it was hard for them to read. They didn't really know what was going on. And that was just because of me. It wasn't that they weren't interested or anything. I just didn't say anything. I didn't really know how to express myself and I didn't want to make everyone worry back home. So I just kind of kept it to myself for the longest time. But my dad, my whole family took my situation pretty hard in college. I think my dad especially, because he was pretty actively involved in the recruiting process and the decision. And so, and also like my athletic journey and all, you know, sharing that with him was a big part of his life. Like a big joy in his life was my going up through the ranks in sports and coaching and watching me and stuff. So to see me, you know, sitting on the end of the bench was really tough for him. And I think he struggled with that a lot. And we had conversations and, you know, part of that was the disconnect of like, because I wasn't honest with them about what I was going through, they assumed that the coach just wasn't giving me a chance in many ways, right? They probably had some idea that, because when I went out to play at the end of games, I didn't look like myself, but they still remembered me from high school. They didn't see practices or anything. So they were encouraging me to like go ask the coach what I could do to earn more playing time. And I was like, yeah, maybe I'll do that. But in my head, I was like, why would I do that? Like, I don't want to play like this. You know, he obviously is making the right choice not to play me. Like, what am I going to get? He sees me at going to ask for more playing time would have been crazy given the situation. Right. But back home, that was the thing. And I let them kind of think that it was just a bad situation and that I wasn't having these difficulties. And then when I finally recovered, you know, sharing that with my family, with my dad was really special, knowing that he was watching the streams of the games and my mom came on senior nights and, grandparents were always. So yeah, the depths of despair led to a deeper appreciation when it all turned around.
It's hard. It's a hard thing to share and to talk about because you don't feel like it describes you, right? Growing up, that was never who you were. And so you kind of have to reckon with this resetting of what your identity was, who you are, and to share that or to admit to that, it's tough, it's hard, and it's not something that you can do easily. And even when you're talking about your closest relationships that you have with your parents, as you said, and your dad's involvement and joy that he got from watching you and seeing you grow up and seeing you play, and then to not really know what you were going through and the struggle, and then saying, well, boy, maybe the coach doesn't know what they're doing. How come he's not playing? And you could see where there's all kinds of things that are wrapped up in what seems like a simple equation, oftentimes very much is not. And for you, it sounds like where it's led you to eventually is to a much better place, a place where you feel like the things that you've learned, you're able to help, or you're going to be able to help lots of other people with some of these struggles. And I know one of the things that you talk about as the book moves along is how this whole process has helped you to think about how to build better habits. So talk a little bit about what you've learned about building good habits through this process and how you feel like, A, that's going to help you in your life, and then B, how somebody who's maybe a part of our audience, whether it's a player or a coach, might be able to help themselves by building good habits.
Yeah. So I think part of the change in habits happened organically as a result of some of the meditation practices I was doing. That's one of the things you notice about the practice is that doing, you know, skillful action, as they call it, is it requires less willpower over time. And it's not, you know, I still struggle with things today. It's not like I've figured all this out, but generally just noticed gradual improvement of, say, during my senior basketball season, when I felt down or stressed or frustrated, my inclination wasn't to run to alcohol or junk food or a party or some, you know, it was more of, okay, I really just need a good night's sleep. And so that was another thing that really helped my senior year, was prioritizing sleep in a way that I never had before. I sort of figured out how important that was, not only for my physical preparation, but also for my mental health and my confidence on the court, was just getting a good night's sleep. It was that simple. Other things like diet, you know, diet wasn't perfect, still not perfect. I'm not a fan of hyper, restrictive diets or anything, but just general, easy, better decisions of not too much refined sugar, eating at better times of the day, you know, not eating right before bed, like stuff like that helped a lot. And then, you know, exercise is built into the athletic experience, but, you know, when you get out of sports, making that a priority too is another pillar on the good habit list in my opinion. So, I think just some simplifying my experience senior year and since then, and resonating with things that really serve me instead of temporary jolts of pleasure that come with, subsequent lows. So like seeking sustainable happiness rather than quick highs that come with lows that come out, like hangovers, right? Whether it's from shitty food or drinking or distraction on social media, it's resonating more clearly over time with habits that serve you and where you want to be in life, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. How important do you think it's been for somebody who may be experiencing something similar to what you've experienced to have guys like Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan, NBA players, to come out and talk about how they've struggled to some degree with whether it's depression or anxiety, and just made it something that people can talk about, especially at the highest levels where the culture usually, or at least in the past, has always been that macho type of stance where I've got to get through it, I've got to tough it out. And I know that that's the culture that I grew up in, at least in my own mind. And I think that's something that I have to fight to overcome. I mean, my first instinct when something isn't going well is I just got to double down on what I'm doing, and I've got to push through it. And in a lot of cases, especially when it comes to the mental side of the game, pushing through it sometimes can just make it worse. So how important do you think it's been to bring that to the public eye through guys like Love and DeRozan?
Yeah, I'm really happy to see that. I think it's really brave of them to open up about that, given that, you know, people are going to look at them a little bit differently because of it, whether that's other NBA teams or contract negotiations. Like, I imagine that there's some of that stuff going through their heads when they decide to share that stuff, right? And so seeing people at the highest levels be open about those struggles, I think gives younger athletes who look up to them an opportunity to reflect on what they might be going through. And you saw some of that with the Simone Biles stuff this last summer, or I guess it was this last summer. You know, that was a huge worldwide moment where all of a sudden everybody had an opinion on athletes and mental health.
For sure.
That was interesting to see. So it's definitely becoming more of a topic, and it's becoming less stigmatized. I've thought a lot about this, obviously, and, you know, I think that there are, we can maybe get to this whenever you're ready, but there is, I still think there's something to the stoicism and quiet courage of pushing forward. But it's like, we have to find the balance between not being ashamed or shaming people who go through it, but we also have to acknowledge that, yeah, like, part of the reason why we admire the Michael Jordans or the Tom Brady's or these amazing athletes who perform under pressure is their mental toughness, right? So it's finding this balance between we need to make it something that we talk about and make, you know, if you're having problems, it's okay to be open about them, but then figuring out ways to support athletes so that they can recover, right?
I think absolutely. And part of it too is that you can get help and you can talk with someone and you can relate to someone else who's maybe going through a similar experience. But ultimately, when you stepped out onto the basketball court or I stepped up to the free throw line, it was still just you and your own mind, and it was still just me and my own mind and that inner, I guess, battle, if you want to call it that, of being able to calm your mind to the point that you could do the things that you knew that physically you were capable of doing, things that you had done for long stretches, long periods of your life. And yet, no matter how much help you get, you ultimately have to be able to handle that and control that and get your mind in the right place. And I think what we're seeing is that athletes can be more open about it, which then allows them to be able to do that inside of their own head. And they can get help from whether it's a sports psychologist, whether it's a concerned and caring coach, whether it's a spouse or somebody who's that they have a relationship with that they can talk to, or your dad, anybody that can allow you to get to a place where you can overcome that anxiety and that block, whatever it might be, that's preventing you from being able to perform at a way that you are capable. Because ultimately, like I said, it's you and your mind and whatever task it is that you're trying to perform. And sometimes the more thinking tasks, it's interesting how you talked about free throws and I talked about free throws where it's slow. It should theoretically be the easiest shot, but yet it was probably, when I was at my lowest low, it was probably easier for me to come sprinting off a down screen and hit a three with a player right there on me than it was for me to step up to the free throw line. And to anybody who hasn't experienced it, hard to relate to. And we've talked about Ben Simmons a couple times, but a guy who has been the best his entire life, and suddenly the ability to step up and what he shoot in the playoffs, 32% last year. I mean, to be able to do that is to overcome that, you know, it takes a lot, let's put it that way. And you hope that anytime I see a guy struggling, you know, you hope that they can overcome it. But Jason and I have had this conversation, this part of the conversation, a bunch of times, that it's hard, because even today there's still moments where that anxiety will flash. And I don't think it ever, at least not in my experience, I don't think it ever completely disappears. I just don't.
Yeah, I've had some big free throws to hit in my city league, washed up league, in the last couple of years. And I have to summon the same skill set.
For sure. Absolutely.
Yep. The same stuff comes back, right?
It does.
Even though there's nobody there.
And right, exactly.
Yeah.
I can be sitting sometimes just on the couch and think about something, or travel back in time, and it will definitely conjure up those feelings. There's no question about that. All right. I want to wrap up, Billy, by asking you one final question, which is, if you had to summarize a self-help paragraph for somebody who was experiencing some type of sports performance anxiety, what advice, based on your experiences, would you give them? And then after you answer that question, we'll give you another opportunity to share where people can find out more about the book, where they can buy it, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So I guess the advice I would give is to start with some kind of daily contemplative practice. That for you, that might be meditation, might be visualization, it might be prayer. Whatever it is, it's something that your phone's away, you're not doing anything. It's a little bit different from like cooking or walking, or it's something where it's just you and you have some kind of deliberate, contemplative, quote unquote, mental training exercise. even if that's 2 minutes a day to begin with, I think that getting into the habit of taking a little bit of time, like you spend so much time on your physical skill sets, right? Strength, conditioning, skill work, strategy, film, to put a minor investment into your mind, I think will have a huge return on investment if you put in the time consistently. Again, it's not something that you can, I liken it to like, you don't want to be the high jumper who waits to sprain an ankle to go practice, right? You don't want to be in a mental crisis to then, oh, now I need to start meditating, right? So if you, wherever you're at, whether you're dealing with issues that were similar to what I was dealing with, or if you can relate to them, or if you're having a good time, but you're moving up in levels and you might be nervous about when you go to college or what's going to happen at the next level, my best advice is just a daily simple routine that is some kind of deliberate mental training regimen. And I think that that can go a real long way in reframing your experience on the courts and giving you a little bit of distance from it and building some mental skill sets.
I would agree. I would add to that, just from my own experiences, I've been thinking more about this as we've been talking, is try to be just in the moment and don't think about the consequences, positive or negative, of what happens as a result of what you do. Just try to do what you do and don't worry about what's going to come out of that, whether that's my field goal percentage is going to go up or my free throw percentage is going to go down. Instead, just focus on what it is that you're trying to do and be in that moment and trust yourself, trust your mind, trust your body that it can do what it's been trained to do. And somehow, some way, that's what I was able to figure out. And like I said, it never got back in my college career to where I was before it happened to me, but I did get back to where I was. I was functional, which was and probably a little bit better than functional, in all honesty. So, which was good. Billy, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on and join us. The book is called Harder Than I Thought, Easier Than I Feared. Again, tell people the website where they can find it, how they can reach out to you if you want to share your social media, share your website again, just so people know where they can find you, where they can find the book, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
All right. And yeah, thank you, Jason and Mike. It's been a pleasure being on the show. Really appreciate the opportunity, so thank you. The book is, you can find it at billyhanson.net/book. That's Hanson with an E if you're looking it up. And you can also find it on Amazon or wherever you shop for books online. The best way to connect with me, you can send me an email, contact@billyhanson.net. I'm not very active on social media, so my newsletter, billyhanson.net/newsletter, is where I give updates on my work and everything else I'm up to. So you can find me there.
Billy, thanks. Really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun for me to have this conversation and take a trip back down memory lane. Not always memories that were great ones, but certainly when I think about my experiences overall, tremendously positive. And the book gave me something to think about today as I read through it and having our conversation. So again, thank you. We are truly appreciative. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.